for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts. The TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. The issues that matter to you and questioning the facts. Ross Cameron on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, g'day. Welcome back. We've got, for your listening pleasure, education and edification, the very distinctive Matthew Carmanzulli. There's only one Matt Carmanzulli. He's became somewhat famous recently when one among a number of actions that he actually brought against the administrative leadership of the Liberal Party made it all the way to the High Court. But Matt wound up with an adverse verdict and the bill, but it was, I believe, a good cause worth fighting, and I think entirely plausible and probable that Matthew was a victim of what John Helmer described as the sort of capitulation taking place in the judiciary. Matthew, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we've got you just fine. Well, look, we didn't really want to, rather than going back through that history, we would just say that you're a person who's got very close. You were a member of the state executive of the Liberal Party of Australia, New South Wales division. For how long would you have been on the state executive?
2019, I think November through, I don't remember exactly what day I got thrown out in 2022, but it was February or March, I think. March,
yeah,
22. So it's a couple of years.
So you had an up close look at the last sort of days of the Baird, Berejiklian, Perrottet government. Why don't you just tell us one of the issues, if you were to describe in a paragraph, there's always more than one cause, but we've just seen the Liberal Party belted from one end of the playground to the other. What do you say are the causes of the election loss? I see indeed one commentator on Sky News who is the former, who is in the New South Wales upper house. Her name tends to escape me because she seems to me to be just such a complete creature of the sort of Photius faction, some sort of a hologram, but ran for pre-selection in the lower house and was rebuffed, knocked back. Who am I? Who is the blonde from the...
Are you talking about Natalie Ward?
Natalie Ward, that's...
The Honourable.
The Honourable, yeah. Natalie Ward, yeah. Well, she said that the Liberal Party lost because of the Conservative faction in the party is the reason why it lost. Well, give us the Carmanzulli thesis on why the result was so stark for Dominic Perrottet and the Liberals in yesterday's election.
Look, I've found times when I agree with Natalie Ward, this I have to say isn't one of those times. Ross, I think we're in a situation now where I believe the Liberal Party certainly has an identity crisis. I think that has to be a big part of the problem. I don't think it understands what it's there for anymore, and until it works that out, it's not going to get a mandate to govern. I believe there are a raft of left-wing and left-leaning options in New South Wales, and they're well-established and well-entrenched. I think the big issue is that I suppose if you try and please everybody, you're going to end up pleasing nobody, and the Liberal Party wasn't sure who it was trying to please. So... In reality, I think the party actually has gone way too far to the left. I think it attempted to attack Labor on issues, particularly with relation to the economy, that were easily from its left or from the Labor's left. Things like the kids' super package. I mean, I don't like adult super too much. I think the whole thing's not working out particularly well for anybody, except for the super funds and the unions. And I think that, you know, to go ahead and try and establish a super fund for children and only make that available to people of means seems to me to have just been a, I don't even know what that policy was trying to achieve, but it seemed like some form of socialism wrapped in, you know, sort of elitist socialism. I don't know what it was, but it was silly. And there were other policies, you know, of that nature. I think there was a voucher for pretty much everything. I haven't used any of the vouchers. I don't have the Services New South Wales up on my phone. I know Victor Dominello did think at one point that the New South Wales Liberal government was a software company, not a particularly good one, mind you, but a software company, and they were trying to sell apps and all sorts of other things to me. But I just couldn't bear it. I couldn't be a part of it. I just think that it's lost the plot in that space. And on social policy, I also think that again the electorate's well served to the left, but the Liberal Party ran to try and assuage every person's concern that Dom Perrottet, whilst he might have been a Christian conservative, wasn't in any way a Christian conservative. I think thereby undermining his reason for being at all. So, you know, that's some of the things. I'm sure there are more. Ross, I'm sure we can go on.
Okay. Well, look, we do have Rob Cribb, who is the kind of data nerd, the numbers guy, the guy who probably knows as much as Anthony Green about who won and who lost and by what margin. He's the former New South Wales president of the Liberal Democrats. Rob, give us your sort of paragraph on why you think the result was so stark.
Well, I think that the Liberal Party failed to prosecute an argument. If you go to an election and you say that we actually agree with our opposition, but we're not going to be so extreme, you will always lose. I think the only way they could have won is if they actually went to the election, they defended their record on, you know, it's hard to defend their record, actually, but if they tried to defend their record and they made a case for small government, then they could have won. But if they, as they did, went to an election with, we agree with the left, but we're not going to be quite as extreme as them, then you're always going to lose. You cannot go to an election and not defend your own position. That never works. So that is.
Well, don't we have to admit we see the Teals didn't quite wreak the havoc that they did first time around, but they've nonetheless made some pretty, you know, pretty impressive gains, it would appear. But don't we have to also begin with the fact that you had, when you have sort of half a dozen or more, there's always going to be some retirements, but it felt like between Brad Hazzard, Jonathan O'Day, Rob Stokes, Jeff Lee, Victor Dominello, and Gabriel Upton, all of whom sort of feared the coming teal wave, yet all of whom found the reason why this was the moment they needed to spend more time with their families, pretty significant demoralising factor when you've got so many of your own team in effect bailing out of the contest.
Absolutely. So I do think that they were kind of scared of the Teals, and I think the results have showed them that they were almost paranoid about the Teals because the Teals have not had a big breakthrough. And we've seen in Hornsby, like a massive swing against Matt Keane that shows the Liberals that if they obsess about the Teals too much, they will like lose votes or potentially seats to other minor right parties such as One Nation and the Liberal Democrats.
Well, who's going to be? And I say, and you know, it goes in a bit to you know, Matt Carmazulu touched on this point. You were making the same argument that we sort of have to go back all the way to if we look at the federal leaders of the Liberal Party. All the way back before John Hewson, even Andrew Peacock, I think, was genuflecting to the idea of, quote, global warming. I mean, John Howard signed us up to, pretty sure it was the Paris Convention, but sort of did a little Scott Morrison-style shuffle where he said, oh, well, we're not going to pass the legislation to implement it, but we are going to sign up to the international agreement.
Oh, that's Kyoto, Ross, wasn't it? Kyoto. Yeah, it was. He never ratified it. Yeah, he didn't ratify it, if you recall.
But what you do find is you don't have any federal or state leader of the Liberal Party prepared to come out and say, this is junk science. This is political science. This is, there is no scientific basis to, you know, you get somebody like Freeman Dyson, the most eminent mathematician of our generation, basically, you know, saying, well, look, I had a very close look at it for several years until I realized it was junk science. Yet we apparently, lions of the Liberal Party, don't have the guts to stand up in front of the sort of pigtails of whatever her name is, and therefore now the chickens come home to roost because we wind up saying, oh, yeah, we are really worried and concerned about climate change, but just not quite as concerned about it as the daft teals.
Yeah, could I say on that, Ross, the big issue that I think really hurts the Liberal Party at the moment, again, and it goes back to that identity crisis, is that they seem to forget not that long ago Tony Abbott came in to power on a thumping majority after having taken a first-term Labor government to minority to rip out a carbon tax. I mean, Scott Morrison replaced Malcolm Turnbull specifically to stop him from doing some kind of climate action, and then won an election, got a mandate not to do any climate action, and then immediately went and signed off on net zero. And Matt Keane was calling Scott Morrison some kind of Luddite because he wasn't moving fast enough, destroying power generation capability, and putting the lights out at a much, much higher cost, mind you, to get no power at all. So you've got to look at that and say, well, you know, if the Liberal Party is there to offer choice against, you know, the sort of things that the left come up with, how could they possibly be leaning into climate change and going further in not only in New South Wales but in other states than what Labor's prepared to do? And then they expect that people will vote for them. And one of the interesting things I've found from all of this is I didn't see a swing to Liberals in green areas at all. I didn't, you know, the areas where there were Greens, the Liberals didn't gain margin. When you leave your friends to work with their enemies, you lose your friends, and their enemies don't respect you. And I think that's pretty much where Matt Keane's put the party.
Okay, well, Rob Cribb, what were there results that you found particularly startling or surprising? Were you surprised to see the former deputy leader of the Liberal Party, Stuart Ayres, get bundled out of Penrith in a George Gregan tackle?
No, I expected most of those things to happen. Actually, the most surprising result to me was that it looks like on current results, and they've only counted a third of the votes in the upper house, that Tania Mihalic will not get elected. That was very surprising to me. I thought One Nation would increase their vote. It looks like on current votes, and I'm looking at the current votes, and I do think that it is city biased, so One Nation's vote will go up as they count some more of the regional votes. But the biggest surprise to me was that it looks like One Nation is going to have a swing against them in the upper house. To me, that is like almost unthinkable before election day, but that has happened.
And what? How do you explain that result? You say, is Tania still? I mean, because there were moments where it looked like mark and One Nation was absolutely surging and might have even contemplated getting three elected, but you're saying he looks like he might be just limited to his own seat being returned.
Yeah, yeah. So it does, like on current numbers, Tanya is not elected. So I do think those numbers will go up and she may be. But I was thinking on, you know, Saturday morning that Tanya would definitely be elected, and I was contemplating the third One Nation, Amit Batish. I was thinking maybe he would get elected. So he has definitely not been elected. So Tanya may be, but she won't be elected on a full quota. It is very much up in the air. And I was very surprised by that. So in terms of why that has happened, some of it might be Tanya herself, who I believe at this election would have run as a Labor Party sitting member if she did not lose a pre-selection. So that may have had something to do with it. But like, I'm not sure. It is very surprising to me, the low One Nation vote.
Matt Carmazzulli, what do you say? How many seats will the Liberal Party win in the Legislative Council?
In the Legislative Council? Look, I've been more focused at the moment on the Legislative Assembly and the results there. Unlike Rob, I'm not as much of an actuary. I don't sit there and look at I did look at the trajectory of percentages for days and days over COVID, but I mean the Legislative Assembly is what floats my boat. But look, I think I'm hearing that the Liberals and Rob, you can correct me if I'm wrong, are going to get the Liberals and Nationals are going to get six for sure, and the seventh one is in doubt at the bottom at the moment. Maybe may get the seventh one on last elected. If I'm not mistaken, but I think that's where that currently sits. But
Rob, what is the answer? Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
Right, the biggest surprise that I've got, and well, I'm not really surprised, I'm sort of half expecting it, is our girl Tanya Davies. What Tanya Davies has shown, because I think she's pulled a positive swing in a sea of swings against. I think the only other place where there was a positive swing towards the Liberal Party was Leslie Williams in the seat of Port Macquarie, but she was actually a Green before, and the swing was against the Greens. So I think she pulled the swing against herself. So I think we can look at that as an anomaly. But Tanya Davies pulled a 1.5% swing. Is currently sitting on a 61.3% two-party preferred, and I think Tanya loves her electorate. And I think her electorate loves her. And I think she was the standout because she actually stood on principle, and she stood for, I think justice for the people in Badgerys Creek and all the people in all the hard lockdown areas, where I think the Liberal Party's taken one of the biggest paths outside of, I think, Matt Keane's own personal seat. You've just got to look at that lockdown policy as just being wrong-headed. I mean, Parramatta has absolutely punished the Liberal Party over that, and I told them that would be what happened.
Mm. And indeed, it may go some distance towards explaining the less-than-expected One Nation result. I mean, I had Mark Latham on as my very first guest on the show. We were sort of, in a sense, willing him to succeed, in part because of a desire to avoid the risk of a Green, Labor, animal justice, fully progressive holding of the balance of power in the Legislative Council. It looks like we could be on track to that result. I'm going to ask Rob Cribb, because the Upper House is a bit more arcane and difficult for people to understand who aren't familiar with the voting process. Even people who've been around it for a long time often don't really understand it. So, Rob, can you just give us the maths of what is a quota and how are the last quotas filled in the absence of a complete quota?
Right. So a quota is about 4.5%, but because of optional preferential voting in New South Wales, a lot of the votes end up expiring. So the last three or sometimes even four positions, so there's 21 positions up for grabs every time. You're looking at 18, 19, 20, and 21 will get elected on less than a quota. And it's very hard to lose if you actually get 2.5%. And that is because so many votes end up exhausting. So if people will vote just one above the line, and it's not just parties that don't get elected at all. So, for example, on current numbers, the Liberal Party have 6.43 quotas, which would mean that Rachel Merton, their number 7, would just miss out. But if people just vote one above the line Liberal, that would mean that their votes go nowhere after that. So that extra almost half a quota would just exhaust. So there's a lot of that happens, which means that the last 4 spots end up being filled by parties that don't have a quota and don't get preferences.
Okay, so boy, does any of the lads wish to express an opinion on who becomes Dom Perrottet? He said he's not contesting the leadership. I don't think he's. I understand he will remain in the parliament. Perhaps somebody can correct me, but I see three various names being speculated about. Matt Carmenzulli, do you want to? What do you say the betting markets should be running on who the next leader of the opposition will be?
Well, look, there are 3, I think, contenders at the moment. one of them is a late entrant. So there's Speakman and Henskins, and the late entrant being Anthony Roberts. Now, I personally think that the Liberal Party needs Anthony Roberts at this particular time to actually give the thing a purpose. I think Alistair Henskins is an exceptional individual, and I don't have any particular problem with him, and I think he'd make a good leader. I think Speakman would represent, and I do think he's a very bright and capable man, but I think he would represent a lot more of the same of what we've seen so far. So personally, I mean, he might well have the numbers in the party room, but I don't even know what this party room is going to settle at. So it's going to be very, very difficult until we see how Oatley goes and how Holsworthy goes. And I think both of those are genuinely at risk of falling. I think we need to see how Wallandilly goes and so on. But I think Robbo would be the best bet. I think he would reset the party and reset the narrative, reset the agenda, and actually oppose Labor and demonstrate to people why they need to vote Liberal. And I think that's important.
All right. Okay. Rob Cribb, do you want to say anything about the Liberal Democrats' chances in the upper house, or you prefer to sit on your hand for the time being?
No, I will go out on a limb. I will say that I think at this point we are very likely to be elected in the upper house. So I will
leave
the upper house numbers. So I believe that we will have 8 Labor, 6 Coalition, 2 Greens, 1 Nation, 1 Legalized Cannabis, 1 Liberal Democrat, 1 Shooters, and 1 that I'm not quite convinced on either way, between either a 7th Liberal, which would be Rachel Mertens, or a 2nd One Nation, which would be Tanya Mihalik, or the Animal Justice Party. But I do believe it's very likely at this point that John Ruddick from the Liberal Democrats has been elected. We're not declaring victory, but I will say that I do think it is very likely.
Okay. Well, because we like to finish on a positive, optimistic, hopeful note after just discussing the carnage in Ukraine, we'll say thanks very much to Matthew and Rob. We appreciate your insights. And let's hope, when we look at New South Wales, my problem was that the single most sort of instructive statistic was that Labor promised to spend $5.3 billion in election promises, and Dom Perrottet promised to spend $5.4 billion. And it seemed to me it didn't really matter who you voted for. You're going to get climate change. Anyway, boys, thanks very much for your company, for your insight. We'll look forward to having you back on another occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us because after this break, we're going to Washington, D.C., where we've woken Adam Crichton from his slumber. He's been writing some cracking yarns this week, and we will review a couple of them. So stick around. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Chris Smith.
The latest policy stance delivered by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis this week on Ukraine. Now, this will upset the mainstream. He does not want the United States to keep funding Ukraine's defense against Russia's invasion. Now, given the fact that he's got a good chance of becoming the next president, this is quite significant. He will withdraw aid to Ukraine. Now, before you all kick up a stink, I agree with DeSantis because it's Europe, not the United States, which should be pitching in the most, and they are not. What is wrong with many of these European giants? It is in their backyard. It's not in the backyard of the United States. It's certainly not in the backyard of Australia. They always leave it to the United States to mop up their mess. Well, if they couldn't contain Vladimir Putin, and I think that's fair enough when it comes to France, they should do and carry the greatest weight in their support for Ukraine. Interesting comments from Ron DeSantis.
Chris Smith on TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Government has taken our rights and will never give them back unless we make them. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Well, look, I'm going to read you boys and girls just half a dozen of Adam Crichton's most recent article headlines, okay? So you get a sense of flavour of the bloke. He is the Washington correspondent for the Australian newspaper. So here we go. Tales of vaccine injury purged from the internet. Do central bankers really know what they are doing? Swedish freedom, quote, best way on COVID, colon, study says. Trump arrest eclipses Biden payments scandal. DeSantis backs Trump over growing storm. China's power grab imitates US tactics. And the last one I'll give you, which warms the cockles of my heart. Subs warning, over budget, late, obsolete. A US defense expert has issued a withering assessment of Australia's $368 billion nuclear-powered submarine deal. I reckon Adam Crichton is so close to perfect as a journalist. It just doesn't matter arguing over the definition of perfection in the last week. Adam Crichton, welcome to the Ross Cameron Show.
Ross, thanks very much. That was very kind of you.
Because I know you sit there. Where do you work? We like to get the visual. When Adam is cranking out the next piece of opinion leading journalism,
well,
where are you sitting? Are you in Georgetown in Washington, D.C.? Where are you?
Very close to Georgetown. So I've been working from home basically since I got here. But it just makes sense. So I kind of work in my lounge room, I guess, at a desk with either CNN or Fox on in the background, just so I don't miss anything. So, just kind of scouring the news.
Is CNN, is that sort of a punishment for something you did in a former life, or it's
I've got to see both sides of the political equation here to know what's going on. So I tend to flick back and forth between them, but I can't bear MSNBC. So I try not to watch that too much to take.
You reckon MSNBC is worse than CNN?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a whole other few kilometres out to the left. Definitely.
Okay. All right, very good. Well, look, I say you are a specimen of a still, in my judgment, independent journalist inside the News Limited stable. I'm not uncritical of the stable, notwithstanding the fact that it's my former, I am a former News Limited asset, as indeed I was a former Fairfax asset, as indeed I was a former ABC asset, or some might say in each case a liability, but nonetheless. I have appreciated the fact that you are not simply rehearsing a News Corp liturgy. You've taken a number of positions which I regard as sort of outlying, even within News Limited. What do you say about the levels of freedom of opinion and conscience that you may exercise as a journalist in a major global masthead?
Yeah, well, look, that's a good question. And I'm often asked that. I mean, I've been at The Australian now about 12 years almost, I think, or something like that. And I've never been told that I can't write something ever. So that might surprise people, but that's the truth. I've found it a very free place to express opinion in writing. I mean, I know there's a perception among some people that there's a, so-called News Corp line, but I don't think that's really true, certainly not amongst columnists. I mean, I think you find the variety of opinion published in the commentary page of The Australian is broader than any other publication in Australia, I'd say. And you certainly see that through COVID. I think the other publications were much narrower in the views that they put forward. And I think The Australian was right to have a broader set of views, because I think, certain of those commentators, and I would actually include myself in that, have been proved right in hindsight. So I think that was very good of the paper.
Well, look, I am a critic of, one of the reasons why I was sort of impressed and did a little salute towards Washington was when I read your headline, "Tales of Vaccine Injury Were Purged from the Internet." I didn't read a lot of tales of vaccine injury in various News Limited publications when they initially started rolling in. There seemed in my mind to be a kind of agreement that because it was desirable to get more people vaccinated, there was a kind of obligation to suppress any evidence that might cause people to become more, quote, vaccine hesitant. But nonetheless, tell us this yarn. You sort of broke the story of the death of Amy Sedgwick.
That was Christine Midup. Sorry. She broke that on Saturday. It was a fantastic, fantastic.
So she was an Australian journalist.
Yes, yes.
And she broke the story. And so then your follow-up is saying that it would previously have been censored, but now it's going to be allowed to breathe and to have
life. Yes. Yes, and that's right. So I saw it. I mean, obviously I get the Saturday paper before anyone else does at home because it was the time difference. So when it goes up, and I was very pleased to see that story on Saturday on our front page. I thought it was a brave, beautiful piece of reporting. Obviously, the situation itself is very, very tragic, but stories like that have just not been told, and it's throughout the media for a couple of years. And I don't think there's been any particular edict. I think journalists have just felt, as you suggested in your introduction, they felt as though they couldn't write about things because there was some sort of public need to persuade people to take the vaccine. But my sense is that damn wall is breaking and indeed has broken. And I think that front page article on The Australian on Saturday was extremely formative. And I think you'll now see a lot more articles like that. You know, I hope we do, because we've certainly heard a lot about COVID deaths for 3 years. I don't think we need to hear any more about that. I mean, of course, they're tragic, being harped upon and harped upon. And, well, speaking of that, the other piece I wrote this week on Sweden, I mean, that's not a directly remit over here in Washington, but I just felt 3 years on that fact that Sweden actually ended up with one of the lowest excess deaths in the OECD is just extraordinary and really needed to be on the front page. I mean, frankly, of every newspaper in the world. It's the greatest.
Well, I was thrilled, very pleased to see your, you know, editors put it on the front. And we see, you know, your opening sentence, Australia recorded relatively more excess deaths during the COVID-19 pandemic than Sweden, which chose not to lock down its population, new analysis from the OECD reveals. Well, I mean, this is just a massive smack in the guts to every so-called COVID expert and chief health officer. I mean, we had putting the fear of God terrorizing the Australian population.
Yep.
You know, people say, you know, we had Brad Hazzard on the weekend say, oh, well, Dom Perrottet failed because he followed Mother Teresa in relation to Gladys Berejiklian, who stood up in front of the cameras every day terrorizing people in what we now see was a completely futile, absolutely sterile, if anything, very damaging to the health of ordinary Australians, and you've cracked it open.
Yes, look, I think it's the greatest humiliation of kind of the bureaucracy in memory. Certainly, I can't think of another one in modern history. It just happened so swiftly. You know, you had all of the elites of the world saying to Sweden that if you don't do this, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to die within months. It's going to be a disaster. And you know, 3 years on, they actually have the best outcome. I mean, it's just, you know, it's almost as if God has a sense of humor, you know. I mean, to put them at the very top, I mean, some of the rankings actually have them as having the lowest, not just among the lowest, which really no one would have predicted, certainly me included in 2020. I mean, I thought the argument would be, okay, Sweden has more deaths, but then we can argue about all the other important things in life. So there was a trade-off. But no, no, you don't need to argue that, because they actually came out the best. It really is, you know, extraordinary. And thank God that there was a counterfactual. Thank God. And, you know, they wanted so much for there not to be, you know, and that's why there was so much pressure put on that country. But you know, the history books will always show that there was a counterfactual, and I think it's going to be very embarrassing in, you know, 10, 20 years when, you know, when historians look back on this period, and of course they'll look at XX deaths. They're not going to look at bloody COVID deaths, but, you know, the classification system is so different across countries. And, you know, let's face it, a big chunk of COVID deaths are people who would have died already in that year. No one likes to admit that, but that's just obvious, you know, given the age profile. Ordinary period.
This is one of the reasons we like Marcus Aurelius, because he says that philosophy is really a preparation for death, for teaching you how to die. Herodotus tells us that Solon, the sage and legislator of Athens, when he met Croesus, the king of Lydia, the owner of the silver mines, he said, I can't really make a judgment about your life until I see the way you die, because the way you die is important. Yet Australia, and indeed the Western world, seems to have just completely lost touch with any of the most basic principles of nature, where the Stoics would say that dying is a part of living, and that we ought not to be shocked by that proposition. We're all going to die one way or the other. Yet these so-called health experts seem to wish to, you know, I remember Josh Frydenberg, what a spiv, what a complete sellout, you know, where Josh Frydenberg came out funding this massive edifice of lockdowns, which was a scientific experiment and experimental drugs, on the basis that no person will die of COVID under my watch, you know. I mean, it was the most infantile, ahistorical behaviour. And he was allegedly the treasurer of Australia. Now, you are an economist. And amongst your moving, as we do, we've been talking about Diogenes of Sinope, who was a banker. Sinope, of course, is the last, if you're travelling up the Black Sea coast before you turn left onto the Peloponnese, you pass the little outcrop of Sinope from which Diogenes came. He was exiled for dilution of the currency. Some speculation about whether he was acting on the instructions of his governor or not. These central bankers, your headline, do central bankers really know what they are doing, Adam Crichton? March 23. Adam, what's the answer to that question? Do central bankers have the first clue what they are doing?
Well, look, in a very small degree, I used to be one. That was my first job, obviously, out of uni. I was at the Reserve Bank for, about four years and a bit, I think, as a graduate. So I do have a lot of respect for the people that work there and at central banks in general. They're very smart people and public-spirited people, I think, in general. But, you know, if you just look at the record over the last 20 years, and I was basing this piece about the Fed and the Fed in particular in recent times, and I just looked at its forecasts 1 year ahead. You know, in 2022 when it started lifting rates, and also just last week. And you know, it had the same forecast in 12 months' time that inflation would be back to 2%, you know, which has not happened, obviously, from 22 to 23. And so I just, you know, it strains credulity to think that's going to happen in the next 12 months. And also we've got this a commentary about the US bank saying that they're very resilient and sound, but on the other hand, we're going to have to slow down interest rating just to make sure we don't cause a financial crisis. So, you know, both of those things can't be true. So they're the two points that I dwelt on in that piece. But I think the bigger, you know, the more interesting aspect is that central bankers have this theory that says the short-term interest rate, which they control, can influence does influence the rate of inflation. But there's actually very little empirical relationship holds. It's it's based on a theory, and a lot of theory. But we have seen in the past year that there have been large increases in rates, and inflation is still very high in the US and in Australia. So you have to start to wonder whether the theory is actually true. You know, so remains to be seen.
Well, look, if we ask, Philip Lowe, the Australian Reserve Bank Governor. I mean, it's sort of a lovely title.
Yes, it is.
A lot of people like to be business figures, feel a certain honour in being appointed to the Reserve Bank Board.
Yes.
On the basis that they possess some priestly insight into the behaviour of the economy and know when to raise and when to lower rates. Yet, it seems to me that if we had paid Philip Lowe to stay home and never go to work for one day, and if we had paid Philip Lowe to never, ever produce a media release from the Reserve Bank of Australia, there would be millions of Australians who would almost certainly be better off than they are right now, as they have their backs to the wall facing, I think, 10 successive interest rate rises, and struggling with, you know, every spare cent of liquidity going into the mortgage because they acted on Philip Lowe's advice that low interest rates were almost a permanent feature of nature.
Yes. Yeah, well, look, certainly it's been a lesson for everyone that you should not trust the forecasts of bureaucrats. I mean, they are always wrong. And I think the fact that many Australians did go and take out mortgages on that advice is very disappointing. And I think, you know, it goes to your earlier point that there is this kind of mistaken belief that central bankers have some insight into the future when you know, of course they don't. I mean, they're fallible and flawed and just kind of muddling on with these theories that they don't even know are true, to be honest. You'd remember in the 80s, everyone used to focus on the money supply, you know, to work out inflation, and that didn't work. So they dumped that theory, and now they focus on the interest rate instead. But that doesn't seem to work either. So I think, you know, the economy is a very, very complex thing, and the financial system in particular. And no one really understands it. And certainly the ordinary person on the street. You know, for instance, people think that banks lend money. I mean, they don't lend money; they make it up. I mean, that's the truth. You know, when you go to the bank and get a loan, they create an asset on one side of their balance sheet and a deposit on the other side, which is for you. So it just comes out of thin air. It's kind of amazing when you think about it, but that's how it works. There's no actual lending going on. They're not finding someone, you know, to give the money to you, from whom to give the money to you. So it's a very, very complex system. And I think Henry Ford once said.
Yes. Hmm? What did Henry say?
Oh, I was just going to say, Henry Ford said, if people actually knew how the banking system worked, that there'd be a revolution. I think he was very right.
Yeah. Well, is this where, you know, the Western civilization comes a cropper? I mean, we see what looks like a sort of a Band-Aid paste-up job of, you know, we're looking after the depositors but not the equity holders. We've seen, you know, what looks to me like a pretty precarious situation going from, you know, the Silicon Valley Bank, and now we're looking at Credit Suisse. And, you know, now there's a big argument about, is Janet Yellen going to give an undertaking to look after depositors in the smaller banks, but or only in the bigger banks? And if it's only in the bigger banks, is there going to be like a ship tilting to one side and the whole cargo sliding when all the big deposit holders in the smaller banks are going to rush to JP Morgan? I mean, how stable is the US financial system at the moment, according to Adam Crichton?
Well, thankfully, they aren't all moving to JP Morgan, because that was certainly justifiable fear of what happened in recent weeks, that was going to happen. People would move to the bigger banks in the belief that they were safer. But, I mean, for me, the most extraordinary thing was just the panicked response of regulators here to the failure of what was a relatively small bank in the scheme of things. I mean, SVB, I think, had something like a couple of $100 billion of assets. So, you know, about a third the size of a or something like that, just to give you the context. And of course, that would be big in Australia, but in the US, it's, you know, it's really nothing. It's far less than 1% of the financial system. And yet they fell over themselves to save not just the insured depositors, but of course all the others too. It's very hard to believe that it was systemic, that bank, if it had have failed. But I guess, you know, you've got to judge regulators by their actions, and they obviously thought that it may have been. So that points to just the fact the banking system is not fit for purpose at all. If it can't withstand the failure of one relatively small bank, and also it supposedly can't put up with even slightly higher interest rates either. Because that was the cause. So I just think it highlights that the financial system is still very, very undercapitalized and fragile, and wasn't really fixed after the financial crisis, despite all the rhetoric around, you know, so-called tough regulations. The regulations were really put in place with the agreement of the most powerful banks, who've actually benefited from them greatly. So, you know, fingers crossed we don't have a financial crisis, but the whole thing's built on confidence. You know, we could wake up on Monday or Tuesday and there's more runs. You know, they're just very hard to predict.
Tell me, I saw Christine Lagarde giving an address to a group of central bankers in which she said, we must act to create the architecture of digital transactions, seemingly to suggest a sort of sanctioned central bank digital currency.
Yes.
Because she said, our role is as an anchor, we central bankers, in the financial system. And if we don't move, as transactions move from analog to digital, we have to move with it, or else not, she said, because it's in the interests of the others in the financial system, but because she said, we central bankers will lose our role as the anchor if we don't create central bank digital currencies. What is the Crichton view on that question?
Yeah, look, there's been a lot of chatter about digital currencies for a long time, but I mean, from the point of view of households as consumers, I don't really see what they add. I mean, from the point of view of governments, they'd love there to be no cash, right? Because then, you know, it would dramatically reduce the amount of crime. So that's how they see it. But I mean, I think it's worth putting up with a bit more crime for, you know, for having personal freedom if you want it. I mean, you know, we use cash for all sorts of things, and I think people like to have that anonymity as an option if they want to engage in transactions. And I don't think the public fully appreciates that there is a push to get rid of cash for this reason. And a lot of people will go along with it. They sure, we need to crack down on crime. Let's go along with it. But they don't realize that will give the government a lot more control over your transactions in terms of being able to see what you do. So I think it's a big philosophical change. I think it's many years away, because I think the politics of getting rid of cash would be very difficult. You know, the great unwashed don't realize, you know, they don't know what digital currencies even are. And they don't care. But as soon as a politician comes along and says, you know, we're going to get rid of cash, I think you'll see a big response, and a very negative one.
Well, again, doofus Josh Frydenberg, you know, he introduced, I think, cash limits, you know, saying you're only allowed to transact, I think, 10,000 in cash, or then somebody must be notified, you know, some bureaucrat.
That's right. Yes, that's right. There was that ridiculous
supervise your behavior. We can go ahead and, you know, get together a group of the NATO gang and conduct a bombing of a piece of civilian infrastructure when we think it's in our interest, but you cannot be trusted with more than $10,000 in cash.
Exactly.
Because apparently you're a bunch of criminals,
exactly.
You know, but we're exactly. Not yet. Okay, so we've got just 4 minutes left. You've had two, and thanks for getting up early. We do appreciate it.
That's all right, no worries.
The most convenient time zone. So DeSantis, Trump, we've got Trump's launched his first in Waco, his first big rally, which characteristically has electrified the mob. We've had DeSantis sort of shifting a bit, in my view, not knowing that he can't really afford to come out and diss Trump's massive supporter base. Where do you think? So he's criticized the idea that Trump was to be arrested, which I think is crazy. Where do you see the Trump DeSantis sort of two bulls in the paddock? Who's got the upper hand at the moment?
Well, look, I mean, you've got to say at the moment, Trump definitely has the upper hand. And I think people are shocked in Washington at how good his polling has been. I mean, just talking to some Republican strategists recently, just a few days ago, talking about this, the very question. And I think people inside the Beltway are shocked at how popular Trump is. I mean, he has huge double-digit leads among Republican voters in relation to DeSantis, and certainly in relation to Nikki Haley and the, you know, trail of other presidential hopefuls. I mean, you know, Trump's up sometimes more than 50% of the Republican voters, and DeSantis is, you know, languishing down on, you know, 20 or even less. And that doesn't seem to have changed in the last 3 months. And we'd all written Trump off in November last year. I certainly had. I remember writing commentary pieces basically saying, you know, his bid was a bit of a joke, but he's proved a lot of people wrong. We have to give him credit for that. Whether this can be sustained for another, you know, what is it? It's more than 12 months. You know, it's still a long way away. The primary season remains to be seen, but it's hard to see how a new scandal it could affect Trump. I mean, he's had kind of every imaginable scandal that there is and still popular with the Republican base. So, and it's hard to see what could happen that could derail him.
Yeah. Well, look, let me put the reverse proposition to you based out of your own article. Trump arrest eclipses, in quotation, eclipses Biden payments scandal. And, you know, I look on at Biden and I see, okay, we've now got incontrovertible evidence that there are payments which have flowed from both Burisma in Ukraine, and now from the CCP to multiple members of the Biden family. But this seems from the Chinese communists, who the US is trying to provoke a war with, while the Biden family's trousering $3 million, splitting it several ways. Why does this have no impact on Biden? We've got 60 seconds to go. It doesn't seem to affect his eligibility at all.
It's a very good question. And I mean, to me, the contrast in focus on Trump's potential arrest and this revelation that only came out, I think, you know, less than 2 weeks ago, certainly, by the House Oversight Committee. And, you know, they're all facts. You know, these are bank records which have been obtained under subpoena power. So it's real. But they have received relatively little attention in the US media.
All right, Adam Crichton, mate, I wish I could keep you all day.
That's okay, Ross. That's fine.
Thanks for joining the Ross Cameron Show. You're full of insight. You are Diogenes Lamp. God bless you. We'll talk again soon. Next time we meet on the Ross Cameron Show.